Hitler's War by David Irving. Waiting for a telegram. When he awoke at 9 a.m. on January 16, 1945, his train was approaching the capital. Snowdrifts concealed Berlin's cruelest injuries. The Reich Chancellery's old wing, scene of his pre-war political triumphs, had suffered unmistakably, and he could make out snow-filled craters in the gardens. A rectangular concrete slab elevated some feet above the ground level marked the site of the deep shelter which Albert Speer had built for him. Hitler decided to sleep in his usual first-floor bedroom for the time being. A hurricane seemed to have blasted through it, but it had been repaired. No stenograms of the next conferences survive, but they were clearly charged with high drama. General Harp's Army Group A had collapsed. Hitler appointed Schirner his successor. He also instructed the Navy to embark 2 panzer and 2 infantry divisions at the Courland port of Liebau immediately, and to bring them by sea to reinforce the main eastern front. Postmortems were held into the catastrophe in Poland. Hitler learned that the 24th Panzer Corps, General Nehring, stationed southwest of Kielce, much too close to the Russian Schwerpunkt, had received telephone orders from Harp to hold Kielce as a quote-unquote hinge without counterattacking, although that was what the panzer divisions were for. Now that the front line had been overrun so, quote, unexpectedly rapidly, unquote, the corps was engulfed. Seething with anger, Hitler ordered Harp to report to him in person. The general calmly produced a Führer order explicitly reserving these decisions to Hitler's whim. Hitler had never seen the order before and concluded that Guderian's staff was responsible. The loss of Warsaw produced another example of the general staff's waywardness. Hitler had ordered the Polish capital defended as a fortress. When Guderian next appeared at the Chancellery, he told the startled Führer that the city had already fallen to the Russians. But even as they were conferring, a radio message arrived from the German battle commandant in Warsaw. He was still holding out, though enveloped on all sides. Hitler ordered the city held at all costs, like Budapest, which was still surviving the Soviet onslaught. However, it was now too late. Asked for an explanation, Guderian blamed his chief of operations, Colonel Boguslav von Bonnen, for the inaccurate report. Hitler ordered Bonnen arrested, exclaiming, quote, "This general staff clique has got to be stamped out," end quote. Once, he had said that he would fight on until a, quote, "peace that is honorable, acceptable to Germany, and will safeguard the life of her coming generations becomes possible," end quote. Faced now with this Soviet invasion, Hitler skeptically authorized Ribbentrop's first cautious feelers to the Western powers. This might yet drive a wedge into the enemy alliance. Sources strongly suggest that it was falling apart. Both Roosevelt and Churchill refused to accept Stalin's quote-unquote Lublin Committee, puppet government, and his proposed frontiers for Poland. After all, Britain had gone to war over Poland's integrity in 1939. Quote, "There must be people in Britain who can see what it is they are demolishing," end quote, Hitler exclaimed in his exasperation to his adjutants. With his Ardennes offensive still causing acute embarrassment to the Allies, Hitler had authorized Ribbentrop, probably on January 2nd, to draw up proposals for the Western governments. By the 19th, when Ribbentrop brought the document to him, the political climate seemed even more propitious. London and Washington could surely find little comfort in the Red Army's immense offensive. The document proposed that Germany retain her national frontiers and renounce both her economic autarky and her ambitions to the hegemony over Europe, that freedom of religion would be restored and the Jews resettled somewhere in an international community. The proposal was stated to reflect the views of, quote, "authoritative sources in Berlin, including the foreign minister," end quote. Hitler approved it. Ribbentrop signed it and sent Dr. Werner von Schmieden, who had a distinguished League of Nations record, to Switzerland to make contact with a Mr. Alan Dulles and an equivalent British official. Now they could only wait for a reply. Meanwhile, Hitler confidently prepared fresh military undertakings in the East. His milieu changed. Martin Bormann, who returned from a 2-week leave on January 19th, bringing Eva Braun to Berlin with him, held regular morning conferences with Hitler. Goebbels and Ley were frequent guests. Dönitz attended almost daily, for his warships were to evacuate hundreds of thousands of civilians from the threatened eastern provinces. On January 20th, the Admiral offered Hitler 20,000 naval troops for the land battles. That same day, Hitler conferred with Speer and Sohr on ways of regaining air supremacy. Goering, Messerschmitt, and other experts crowded his study. He ordered once again the heaviest cannon and air-to-air missiles, like the R-4M rocket, to be mass-produced for the fighter squadrons. Jet fighter development was to continue at top priority. This long-term planning showed that Hitler still expected a 7 years' war. By weakening the Western Front, he hoped to raise an army of assault in the east before the end of February 1945. This would head off the Russian invasion. Meanwhile, the Western enemy would be harried by more aggressive warfare from Hitler's Atlantic quote-unquote fortresses, Lorient, Saint-Nazaire, La Rochelle, and North Guernica, and their long lines of communication would be disrupted by U-boat, mine-laying, and midget submarine operations and Luftwaffe attacks. On January 19th, Dönitz endorsed Hitler's delaying strategy. 107 of the secret Mark 21 U-boats were already fitting out, and the first were to begin operations in March. Late on January 19th, Hitler began to consider transferring the 6th SS Panzer Army to the east, but events were rapidly overtaking his decisions, and he knew that weeks would pass before the Panzer Army could contemplate its transfer. Martin Bormann wrote in his diary, quote, "Midday, situation in the east growing increasingly menacing. Evacuation of the Werthergau. Tank spearheads approaching Katowice, etc., etc." End quote. Hitler concluded that the strategic danger to the Reich lay in Hungary and Austria, where Stalin was preparing with an army of inferior troops to capture the last remaining petroleum fields south of Lake Balaton and in the Viennese region. On January 20th, Hitler confided to press chief Otto Dietrich, quote, "I'm going to attack the Russians where they least expect it. The 6th SS Panzer Army's off to Budapest. If we start an offensive in Hungary, the Russians will have to go too." End quote. His plan for a rapid pincer attack launched from both ends of the 50-mile-long Lake Balaton to unhinge the southern end of the Russian front was for rapid pincer attack. On January 21st, he cabled Weichs, the commander-in-chief southeast, to investigate the feasibility of a simultaneous thrust by three or four divisions from Croatia across the Drava into southern Hungary. Weichs replied the next day in terms of conditional approval. When Guderian, exhausted by poor health, protested that he needed the 6th Panzer Army to defend Berlin, Hitler caustically replied, quote, "You intend operating without gasoline? Fine! How far do you think your tanks will get?" End quote. His orders stood. In Poland, Krakow and Lutz were overrun. The clock was being remorselessly turned back. To release a corps for East Prussia, Hitler ordered Memel abandoned and its dockyard destroyed. On January 21st, he authorized General Hossbach's badly mauled 4th Army to fall back on the line of lakes on either side of the well-provided fortress town of Lutzen. That day, Hitler announced that the Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler would take over command of the new army group Vistula, whose mission would be to prevent the enemy from breaking through to Danzig and Posen and isolating East Prussia. Himmler was also to quote, organize the national defense on German soil behind the Eastern Front, entire Eastern Front, end quote. He hoped for a ruthlessness and tenacity from the Reichsfuhrer that was lacking in the elderly, worn-out army generals. 2 days later, the Russians reached the coast at Elbing, cutting off East Prussia. On the 24th, Hossbach withdrew the 4th Army to the west and abandoned Lutzen without permission or a fight. Confronted with his fait accompli, Hitler exploded, quote, "Hossbach and the Russians are hand in glove," end quote. He dismissed the general and his entire staff immediately. To Jodl, Hitler compared this treachery with the Avranches affair, which had begun the fall of France. He invited Goebbels around on the 24th. From now on, the propaganda minister, brave and true, was a regular evening visitor. His diaries had, however, only one reverse after another to record. Russian tanks were now rolling into Upper Silesia. The industrial province to which Hitler had evacuated his most precious war factories.
Auschwitz and its essential rubber factory were overrun. The conference records show that Hitler, told of the loss of Auschwitz, merely registered the fact. Posen was encircled on January 27th. The long, hard fight for possession of the city began. It would end only 1 month later with the death of its commandant and surrender to the Russians after they had threatened to massacre the injured Germans in their hands. Millions of Germans began fleeing westward. Every road to Berlin, Dresden, and the West was choked with fleeing refugees. The Navy would evacuate 450,000 from the port of Palau over the next weeks. 900,000 more set out on foot despite sub-zero temperatures. Along the 40-mile causeway to Danzig or across the frozen lagoon known as the Frisches Haff. Behind them, the invading Russians, incited by Stalin and by an order signed by Marshal Zhukov himself, and there's an asterisk, Zhukov's long order of the day fell into German hands. It was headed, quote, "death to the Germans," end quote, and announced in uncompromising terms that the hour had come for the Red Army to wreak revenge on Hitler's cannibals, quote unquote, Hitler's cannibals. Quote, "We will take revenge for all those burned to death in the devil's furnaces, poisoned in the gas chambers, shot and martyred. We'll take cruel revenge for them all. Woe betide the land of murderers. This time we shall destroy the German breed once and for all," end quote. And end asterisk note. Back up. Behind them, the invading Russians, incited by Stalin and by an order signed by Marshal Zhukov himself, raped, pillaged, burned, and plundered. Galen's intelligence branch confirmed, quote, "refugee columns overtaken by Soviet tanks are often machine-gunned and then crushed beneath them," end quote. After spending an hour with Hitler on the 28th, Goebbels thoughtfully dictated, quote, "If the Führer should succeed in turning back the tide of events, I am firmly convinced that the chance will one day come for that. Then he will not be the man of the century, but the man of the millennium," end quote. All Germany listened on January 30th to Hitler's radio broadcast, the last he would ever make. It was all over in just 16 minutes. His private adjutant, Alvin Broder Albrecht, wrote the next day, quote, "From all sides, the response to the Führer's speech has been indescribably positive, however gloomy the omens may be. What moved me most deeply was one telegram that arrived today from a refugee column trekking from the east." It just read, quote, "Führer, we trust in you," end quote, signed, quote, "a column passing through so-and-so," end quote. Hitler ordered Berlin's buses to rush loaves of bread to the refugee columns heading for the capital. Ever westward and northward, the Russians swept, across frozen rivers and frosted fields. On January 27th, Schirner had to order the Upper Silesian industrial region abandoned. 2 days later, Königsberg was isolated, and on the 30th, the Russians reached and bridged the Oder only 50 miles from the center of Berlin. Hitler instructed Guderian, quote, "Over the next few days, I must be told everything that is known about the enemy's movements, and the most likely directions of attack and assembly areas, because our own countermeasures will depend on them," end quote. Quote, "Jawohl," answered Guderian. One belief consoled Hitler, the consternation that this Soviet avalanche must be causing in London and Washington. He instructed Ribbentrop to feed to the British intelligence networks a phony report that Stalin was raising an army of 200,000 German communists under General Paulus and other captured German officers. This army was to march westward and set up a puppet government, for example, in Königsberg. Quote, "That'll shake them, like being jabbed with a cobbler's awl," end quote. In a further recorded dialogue with Jodl and Goering on January 27th, Hitler mused, quote, "I don't know. Do you think the British can still be watching this entire Russian development with a thrill of excitement?" "No, definitely not," replied Jodl. "Their plans were quite different." "They certainly never bargained," seconded Goering, "for us standing firm in the West and letting the Russians conquer all Germany. Meanwhile, if it goes on like this, we'll be getting a telegram in a few days' time. They went to war to stop us moving east, not to have the East coming right up to the Atlantic," end quote. It was in this mood that Schadenfreude that Hitler conducted two lengthy conferences with Ribbentrop early in February, and then on the 7th with SS General Karl Wolff, now police chief representative in occupied Italy, as well. Wolff described the Western Allies, quote, increasingly concrete peace feelers extended via Switzerland, end quote. Hitler took note of his remarks and thus encouraged, Wolf began secret talks with the same Mr. Dulles whom Herr von Schmieden had been sent to contact in Switzerland. At the Reich Chancellery, the broadcast of Hitler's January 30th speech was followed by the premiere of Dr. Goebbels' most ambitious color movie ever, Kullberg, the story of one of the most stirring battles in the Napoleonic Wars. Hitler never saw it, but the film was dispatched by fighter aircraft to inspire the German garrisons of the remaining Atlantic fortresses. Quote, "These times call for the lion-hearted," wrote one of his adjutants after seeing Kullberg, "so it is salutary to be reminded of what previous generations suffered in the fight for our nation's survival. The film matches present history so well that its originators and work began on the film in 1942 must have had clairvoyant powers," end quote. 2 weeks had passed since the Soviet invasion began. Schirner's army group had now claimed 1,356 enemy tanks destroyed, and the army group in East Prussia a similar number. The fortress city of Posen, where German-speaking officer traitors had infiltrated the lines, was still holding out, but the strongholds Chelmno, Thorn, and Marienwerder had to be relinquished by Himmler's makeshift army group. Hitler authorized these painful retreats. On January 30th to 31st, it was 5:30 a.m., before he retired to be awakened at noon by Bormann with the alarming news that the Russian tanks had just crossed the frozen Oder River between Kusten and Riesen. The Oder was the last major river before Berlin. Its western tanks were defended only by the Volkssturm battalions. While these elderly soldiers slowed down the Russian onslaught, Hitler directed that over 300 heavy anti-tank aircraft batteries, including the entire anti-aircraft artillery of cities like Dresden, be transferred to Oder Line's anti-tank defense. All fighter planes were committed to the Silesian and East Prussian battlefields, because most could now carry bombs, as Hitler had always demanded. Thus, the crisis was overcome. In weakening the Reich's air defenses, Hitler perhaps hoped the Allied bombers might be called off, just as those still German-occupied islands in the Aegean were very obviously being left unmolested by the British. Quote, "so that the British do not need to defend them against the Russians or any other usurpers," end quote, the German naval staff observed. The German commandant of the Eastern Aegean had even received a secret British offer to carry supplies to the German-held islands on British steamships. In Breslau, 38 Volkssturm battalions had been raised. With these 15,000 men and 30,000 regular troops, Breslau defied air and artillery bombardment and ground attack in a long siege that was not ended until a week after Hitler himself had perished. Hitler knew, however, what the loss of the Silesian coal would mean. Now that the Ruhr was virtually isolated by the rail and canal destruction, Germany's economic collapse seemed inevitable. Japan was in a similar plight, without rice, oil, bauxite, and iron ore. Hitler's attaché in Tokyo warned that Japan, too, could not fight on longer than another year. The oil crisis had already forced on Hitler a strategic choice between East and West anyway. In January, his battered refineries had produced only 50,000 tons of gasoline and 12,000 tons of aviation fuel. It was unlikely that the new U-boats and jet aircraft 145 ME-262 jets had been produced during January alone, would get the oil they needed. At the end of January, Hitler ruled that in the future, the Western Front must go short of fuel and ammunition to aid the Eastern Front. Rundstedt had to forfeit fuel to replenish the 6th SS Panzer Army before its departure for Hungary, although at any moment Eisenhower might begin his new offensive toward the Ruhr. The American Air Force now joined in the British saturation bombing campaign. With the fighter squadrons still committed to the Oder battlefront, the big cities were defenseless. To exploit the refugee chaos in Berlin, the Americans sent 1,003 heavy bombers at noon on February 3rd, 1945. These unloaded 2,200 tons of bombs into the heart of the capital, while not one aircraft climbed to the city's defense. The raid left the government quarters a shambles. Hitler took refuge in the new bunker. Bormann recorded, quote, "The Reich Chancellery Garden is an amazing sight. deep craters and fallen trees, and the paths obliterated by rubble and debris. The Fuhrer's residence was hit several times, and only fragments remain of the walls of the Winter Garden and Banqueting Hall. End quote. Goebbels brought his family into Schwanenwerder, where there were better shelters than out at Lanka. Quote, Papa and I, wrote Magda Goebbels to her oldest son, now in British captivity on the 10th, are full of confidence and we're doing our duty as best we can. End quote. Ribbentrop brought his young son down into the bunker as the fires still raged in the Wilhelmstrasse. Rudolf had last seen Hitler in 1940 and was shaken to see the aged, bent man who greeted them near one of the fireproof doors. Quote, But the tide is turning, he recalls Hitler as saying. Every day a new regiment is reaching the front. Regiment, the young Waffen-SS officer was easy at the word. And my young field marshals will bring the front lines to a standstill, end quote. He named those whom he meant and added, quote, The most brilliant of all is Manstein, but he can't halt a front line that's begun to collapse, end quote. The all-clear sounded and life outside resumed. Hitler's adjutant Albrecht wrote 2 days later, quote, Some 25 bombs fell on our district. There's no water, no heat, no electricity. By roundabout, route water reached the main points again after 24 hours, but we'll have to wait another 2 weeks for heat, unless our visitors return in the meantime, for which possibility we are bracing ourselves. End quote. Mercifully, along the Oder, the ice was now thawing, bringing a respite to the defenders. Hitler ordered icebreakers and explosives to be used to speed up the process. By February 8th, the immediate danger to Berlin had passed, but important Wehrmacht command posts were ordered to leave, and provision was made for the ministries to follow if need arose. Bormann began preparing an emergency headquarters for Hitler at Stolpe in Mecklenburg. The Luftwaffe was powerless. Every fresh disaster was now laid at Goering's door. A Soviet submarine sank the former cruise liner, Wilhelm Gustloff, drowning over 9,000 souls, mostly refugees from East Prussia. The hospital ship Steuben was torpedoed some days later, drowning nearly all the 2,500 casualties and 1,000 refugees. A tenfold of the losses of Titanic. Dönitz blamed Goering for failing to provide anti-submarine patrols. Anxious Reichsmarshal signed strings of belated death sentences on Luftwaffe officers for offenses ranging from desertion, espionage, corruption, and loose living to allowing aircraft, fuel, and bomb dumps to fall into enemy hands. For every sin that Goering punished, Bormann could always prove 10 more against him. When Lammers ventilated the delicate matter of Hitler's successor, Bormann contemptuously advised that Goering was out of the running. Goering's very presence in the cramped air raid shelter revolted the Führer, since both the Reichsmarshal and his adjutant Dr. Ramon Andarza made liberal use of conflicting colognes, with which the shelter's air purification system could not cope. No word had yet come from the Western powers. No telegram in Bulgaria. King Boris's successors had been shot by the new communist regime. In Poland, Stalin's new puppet government proclaimed the forthcoming annexation of Silesia and East Prussia. On February 8th, Marshal Kunev attacked from the Steinau bridgehead across the Oder with the obvious aim of encircling Breslau, and a big Allied offensive developed between the Rhine and the Meuse. Far into the night, Hitler sat talking with Bormann, the architects Speer and Giesler and Eva Braun, who was returning to Munich the next day. Toward morning, Hitler was informed that the British had destroyed the Politz synthetic refinery, the Luftwaffe's last gasoline source. Yet he had still not lost hope. Late on February 9th, Professor Giesler unveiled to him his model for the reconstruction of the city of Linz. Hitler had decreed that Linz must replace Budapest as the Danube's fairest city. It was to have a concert hall seating 35,000 and a bell tower 500 feet high, with Hitler's parents entombed in a crypt at its base, on the north bank, and a major replanning of the old city in the south. A wide ceremonial mall was to extend from the railroad station to the city center, flanked by opera houses, theaters, a museum, library, and immense art gallery. Now in Giesler's model, it all took shape before Hitler's eyes. At 4 a.m. that morning, February 10th, he again stole into the shelter where the model was laid out, and he returned at 3 a.m. the morning after. When Kaltenbrunner came with reports of declining public morale, Hitler took the SS general himself, a native of Linz, into the model room. For many minutes, Hitler described how Linz would arise anew when victory was theirs. As the ponderous, scar-faced general slowly warmed to the theme, Hitler challenged him, quote, "My dear Kaltenbrunner, do you imagine I could talk like this about my plans for the future if I did not believe deep down that we really are going to win this war in the end?" End quote. The Russians had been held off about 70 miles from the Pomeranian coast by Himmler's army group, leaving an inviting 300-mile flank for the Germans to attack. Since early February, Guderian had been planning to exploit this, but the rate of buildup for his counterattack was slow, and Himmler expressed a marked reluctance to risk his forces. On February 10th, Hitler called both Guderian and Himmler to the Chancellery. Guderian pleaded for the attack to be brought forward. Quote, "We can't wait until every last can of gasoline has arrived," end quote, and demanded a capable army general for Himmler's command staff. He suggested his own deputy, General Wenck. According to Guderian, the argument lasted 2.5 hours. Eventually, he got his way because Hitler smiled warily and instructed Himmler, quote, "Wenck will be attached to your staff," end quote. The attack would be brought forward to the 15th. In the event, the operation from south of Stargard was a failure. On the third day, Wenck was injured in a motor accident. The attack lost all further impetus, and Hitler called it off. Guderian's star began to wane. Learning that the general had recently advised Ribbentrop that the war was lost, Hitler made a terrible scene at the next war conference. Quote, "In a situation like this," said the Führer, "any sign of defeatism is open treachery. That is what General Guderian's recent discussion with Ribbentrop amounts to. It must be clear to everybody that if I throw an ordinary workman who mutters defeatist remarks in an air raid shelter into a concentration camp or hang him, I must expect at least as much from you. This kind of sedition has got to stop." End quote. From Yalta, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin announced on February 13th that Hitler's Reich was to be carved up between the victors into quote-unquote occupation zones. The Yalta communique sent in to Hitler page by page as it came over the teleprinters elicited a hoot of triumph from him, quote, "So much for the drivel talked by our coffeehouse diplomats and foreign ministry politicos. Here they have it in black and white. If we lose the war, Germany will cease to exist. What matters now is to keep our nerve and not give in," end quote. That evening, Hitler again stole downstairs to view the models for the rebuilding of Linz. He dined at 8 with 2 secretaries, then slept until it was time for the midnight war conference. Here the news was that since midday, Breslau had been encircled and that 300 British heavy bombers had just set the ancient heart of Dresden alive with 1 million refugees on fire. Before the conference was over, word arrived that a new British attack, twice as heavy as the first, had begun. The city had no shelters or flat guns, and no fighters were operating. From Dresden itself, there was a merciful silence, as all the telephone lines were down. British codebreakers could hear Himmler radioing to his police chief, frankly incredulous about the scale of disaster. Quote, "I have received your report," lectured Himmler in this message. "The attacks were obviously very severe, yet every first air raid always gives the impression that the town has been completely destroyed. Take all necessary steps at once," end quote. It was 6:15 a.m. before Hitler retired. At 1 p.m. the next day, February 14th, he was awakened with word that the American bomber forces were continuing the immolation of Dresden. The, quote, "Florence on the Elbe," unquote, had vanished, and huge fires were raging. After the all-clear sound in Berlin, Hitler was surprised to meet in a chancellery hall the Army ENT specialist, who had treated his ear injuries after July 20th. Dr. Giesing had been visiting an adjutant when the alert sounded. Twice the Führer absently asked where his family was. Twice the doctor replied, quote, "They are in Krefeld, mein Führer," end quote. Twice Hitler then asked Giesing which hospital he worked at, and twice the doctor told him. Then Hitler turned to the war. Quote, "In no time at all," he said, "I'm going to start using my victory weapon, Siegwaffe, and then the war will come to a glorious end. Some time ago, we solved the problem of nuclear fission, and we have developed it so far that we can exploit the energy for armaments purposes. They won't know what hit them. It's the weapon of the future. With it, Germany's future is assured. It was Providence that allowed me to perceive this final path to victory." End quote. And there's an asterisk. Giesing wrote this account on June 21st, 1945, 6 weeks before Hiroshima. The origin of Hitler's optimism is puzzling. Scientists under Professors Werner Heisenberg and Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker had been studying atomic bomb physics since 1939, and they started building an experimental atomic pile at Hagerloch in 1944. In December, the Reich Chief of Nuclear Research, Professor Walter Gerlach, appealed to Bormann for exemption for them from Volkssturm service and speciously mentioned their quote-unquote atomic bomb research as justification. And that's all of that. Back up. Final path to victory, end quote. His gaze remained rooted to the floor. He again asked the doctor where his family lived. Quote, in Krefeld, mein Führer. The night's death toll in Dresden was estimated to him at 250,000. Quote, they flatten the Dresden Opera House and wipe out the refugees, he exclaimed. But Stettin Harbor, jam-packed with troop transports, they leave alone, end quote. At 7:15 p.m. on February 14th, Hitler discussed Dresden for 45 minutes with Goebbels. The minister insisted that Reichsmarshal Goering be brought before the People's Court. Hitler would not hear of it. He was the picture of dejection. Quote, morale poor, entered Professor Morell in his diary on the 15th. Seems mistrustful, thanks to the situation on the Eastern Front and the air raids on Dresden. End quote. 2 days later, the physician added, after seeing Hitler at 2 p.m., quote, says he has no complaints at all apart from the tremor, which I observed last night at tea, is now badly affecting his left hand, too. During our conversation, he voiced a wish that I might sometime try a few shots of strophantin, say 3, as these once worked for an entire year. These last 4 or 5 days, Hitler has seemed extremely subdued. He looks tired and sleepless. The Führer will try to get by without sedatives. End quote. Goebbels proposed that Germany abandon the Geneva Convention and execute one Allied prisoner henceforth for every German civilian killed in air raids. Hitler liked the idea. Quote, this constant sniveling about humanity will cost us the war, he complained. Neither the Russians in the East nor these hypocrites of the West stick to the Geneva Convention. Just look at their attacks on the civilian population. End quote. According to the staff stenographer present, Heinz Bescholtz, Hitler emphasized that the Russians had demonstrated what could be achieved by ruthlessly punishing enemy airmen. Quote, our airmen couldn't be persuaded to fly over Moscow or Leningrad for their lives, but the Russians began executing Luftwaffe airmen. They just published that, quote-unquote, enemy parachutists had been found and exterminated. End quote. The idea of repudiating the Geneva Convention did not, however, commend itself to the party or the Wehrmacht. Keitel, Jodl, and Dönitz opposed it. Ribbentrop, summoned by his horrified liaison officer, Walter Huell, ultimately talked Hitler out of the idea during a 40-minute stroll with him in the blitzed Chancellery Gardens on February 21st. In stacks of 500 at a time, Dresden's air raid victims were publicly cremated on makeshift grids of steel girders. Hitler saw the pictures, the thousands of men and women and children still in their Mardi Gras fancy dress costumes being stacked like rotting cabbages onto the bonfires. Where was the justice in history if an enemy could vanquish Germany by means such as these? This was the mood that impelled him now. A vivid description of Hitler in late February 1945 exists, rendered by one of the Gauleiters summoned to the Chancellery at 2 p.m. on February 24th. On the previous day, the Americans had unexpectedly begun their big offensive across the Aurora River, river east of Aachen. On this February 24th, the Red Army had just begun an unexpected attack on Himmler's thin line defending Pomerania. Only in Hungary had a modest success been achieved, with the destruction that day of a Russian bridgehead across the Grand River after days of arduous fighting. When Hitler entered one of the few still undamaged chancellery halls, he found 60 or 70 of the Gauleiters and officials lined up around 3 sides. He shook hands with each of them, then invited them to a simple luncheon, stew followed by a cup of real coffee. His subsequent oration gained in strength as the customary climax was reached. He talked of a forthcoming counterattack in the East, an operation which had been delayed by the losses of heavy weapons. He referred wistfully to deceased General Huber and wished he had more generals, quote, carved of the same oak, end quote. He asked for a supreme final effort from the party so that the war might still be won. They must bring out a Führer Teutonicus on the people, If the people now gave up, they would deserve annihilation. In conclusion, Hitler mentioned to the Gauleiters his own declining health. Friedrich the Great, he said, had also returned from his wars a broken man. At one stage, Hitler tried to convey a glass of water to his mouth, but his hand trembled so much that he abandoned the attempt. Perhaps it was an act of showmanship, for he concluded with a smile, quote, "I used to have this tremor in my leg, now it's in my arm. I can only hope it won't proceed to my head. But even if it does, I can only say this, my heart will never quaver." End quote. 6,000 to 8,000 Russian tanks had been claimed destroyed since mid-January. Still, the General Staff's belief was that the Red Army's next move would be the assault on Berlin. The very day of Hitler's speech proved these experts wrong. Instead of continuing the westward, Marshal Zhukov turned north against Himmler's army group in Pomerania. On the 27th, he broke through Himmler's lines. Two enemy tank armies, which Galen had believed were preparing to exploit the Kursten bridgehead, now emerged far to the northeast, racing toward Koslin and the Baltic coast. Hitler promised immediate reinforcements to Himmler for a counterattack, and he ordered the historic Danzig corridor held at all costs. Meanwhile, all manner of deception was to be used to persuade the Russians that between the Oder front and Berlin, a deep and impregnable defense had been established. Unless Himmler's counterattack succeeded, the loss of East and West Prussia seemed inevitable. Speaking with his Führer on the 27th, Goebbels suggested that they could have only one realistic aim now, namely, to set a heroic example to their children's children, in case a similar misfortune should ever befall their country. It was not an inspiring argument, but Hitler agreed. On March 3, 1945, he paid his last visit to the front line. He drove to 1st Corps headquarters in the bridgehead at Frankfurt on Oder to inspect for himself the unit's strengths and their stocks of ammunition. Quote, "The visit was primarily to the new divisions, Doberitz and Berlin," end quote. Goebbels dictated afterward, quote, "The effect on officers and other ranks was enormous," end quote. Refugees swirled past the Führer's car in anonymous multitudes. 10 million were now fleeing the Russian tanks and guns. On the road back from the Oder River to his capital, Hitler sat next to his chauffeur, Erich Kempe, lost in his own thoughts. Visiting him the next evening, Dr. Goebbels hinted that he might drive out to the battlefields more often to put a stop to the wretched rumors that he did not bother about his troops. Quote, "In contrast to last time," recorded Goebbels, "I found him somewhat downcast, which is no surprise given the military turn of events. His health is also something of an impediment. The nervous tremor in his left hand has worsened badly. It was a shock to me," end quote. He himself revealed that, come hell or high water, he intended to stay in Berlin with his wife and children. While Hitler was still, by and large, in good heart, his generals were not, and Goebbels was glad to leave the building. Quote, "The atmosphere in the Reich Chancellery is pretty grim," he dictated next morning. "I'd prefer to not go there again because you can't help being infected by the mood," end quote. Professor Morell had not accompanied Hitler to the front. The doctor was confined to bed with thrombophlebitis. Hitler called on him on March 4th and told him how glad he was that the doctor had not driven out with him. Still worried about Morell, he visited the doctor again the next day and pleaded with him, according to the latter's diary, never to accompany him to the front. Quote, "Because I should be exposed to serious injury from an accident or low-flying planes, and if anything should happen to me, he would be without a doctor again," unquote. Quote, "It is far more important," said Hitler, "to know that I shall always find you waiting for me when I get home," end quote. Germany's military reserves were long since exhausted. On February 27th, Jodl showed Hitler a telegram from Rundstedt, forcefully complaining that of the 52,215 soldiers promised him in February, only 11,802 had come. Desertions reached epidemic proportions. Bormann's staff proposed public hangings of cowards and deserters under the slogan that Gauleiter Karl Hanke had found effective in his fanatical defense of Breslau. Quote, "Death and dishonor to those who fear an honorable death," end quote. Hitler proposed to Himmler two radical solutions designed to shame the deserters back into their units. To attain, quote, "a suitable effect on the men's attitude," unquote, the Reich women's leader, Frau Gertrude Schulz-Klink, should be consulted on the creation of a women's battalion. Secondly, 6,000 youths of 15 were to be recruited to reinforce Himmler's rear lines of defense. Bormann somberly observed to his staff in a memorandum, quote, "This means that we are now calling up women and 15-year-olds to strengthen the front," end quote. Turkey, Egypt, Finland, and a host of South American countries now declared war on Germany. In the West, on February 28th, the Americans began advancing on the Rhine between Dusseldorf and Venlo. American tanks flying German colors tried to rush the Rhine bridges at Dusseldorf and Uerdingen, but these and every other bridge from Duisburg down to Koblenz were destroyed in the nick of time. The apathy of the people west of the Rhine shocked Hitler. White flags fluttered everywhere. Local farmers attacked German troops. At Trier, the Volkssturm melted away. Other Volkssturm units were reported throwing bazookas, machine guns, and ammunition into lakes and rivers. At Remagen, American troops entering the town were astonished to find the railway bridge across the Rhine still intact and flung an immediate armored bridgehead onto the eastern shore. Most of Cologne was overrun. By March 8th, the situation in the east was also worse. Pomerania seemed lost, and with it Hitler's faith in Himmler. Pleading angina, the Reichsfuhrer SS had abandoned his command staff for a health clinic at Hohenleiken, his staff described as, quote, utopian, unquote. Hitler's orders to seal the breach in Pomerania's defenses. On March 4th, General Hans Krebs, deputizing for the injured Wenck, quoted to Hitler the blunt objections telephoned by General Kinzel, Himmler's operations officer. Quote, "This war is being fought on paper. It's quite divorced from reality," end quote. A year before, Hitler would not have tolerated such criticism, but now he had to swallow it because each military defeat eroded his authority. He decided on a more limited eastward counterattack from Stettin instead. General Erhard Rauss's 3rd Panzer Army would receive the necessary reinforcements by March 6th. His 3rd SS Panzer Corps, under General Martin Unrein's command, announced that it had enough ammunition for the first 2 days' attack. Hitler, cautious ever since Avranches, sent an SS adjutant to Stettin to attack. This man, SS Major Johannes Goller, reported back that the divisions had no ammunition at all. Quote, "On the drive up to Stettin," wrote Goller privately, "we passed endless columns of refugees who had set out weeks ago. Everybody from corps commanders downward wanted to know about the Führer's health, about how things are on other sectors of the front, and more than anything, about whether we can hope for further V-weapons," end quote. On the afternoon of March 8th, General Rauss came to the bunker to explain his army's defeat in Pomerania. He pointed out that his army's 8th divisions, with only 70 tanks between them, had held a line 150 miles long against eight Soviet armies and 1,600 tanks. Hitler interrupted pedantically, quote, "1,400! The battle had been illuminated by many acts of bravery. Out of 34 Soviet tanks attacking the naval-held bridgehead at Divnau on March 7th, only one escaped destruction. And this very morning, the same naval troops had charged across open country and wiped out all 36 attacking tanks. In the battles, 500 enemy tanks had been knocked out, 360 by bazooka. Hitler was unimpressed and decided to dismiss Rauss. Quote, "He is too nondescript, bogged down in petty details," unquote. Manteuffel would replace him. That day, March 8th, 1945, Guderian predicted that since the Pomeranian threat to the Red Army's northern flank had now collapsed, Stalin's main attack on Berlin would begin, quote, "in about 1 week," end quote. Goering came to venture the suggestion that it might be time now to, quote, "clear the air politically," end quote. Hitler snorted angrily that he would do better to clear the air, period. How high he set his chances now, we do not know. On March 13th, he lightly assured Otto Meissner, then 65, that he was to stay on to enjoy Germany's peacetime reconstruction. Quote, "I can't let you retire until you're 70, end quote. In 1950. Brooding over what might have been, he showed Goebbels the shorthand record of the conferences in which he had predicted that the Russian army would make for Pomerania before Berlin. The general staff had insisted it knew better, and had now been proven wrong. The two men walked grimly over to see firefighters damping down the ruins of the propaganda ministry further down the Wilhelmstrasse, wrecked by a British 4,000-pound blockbuster bomb a few hours before. 2 nights later, Hitler was inspiring Kesselring with promises of a great, quote-unquote, defensive victory coming in the east, after which Germany's tank output would revert to the Western Front. He ordered a sudden northward thrust from the Ninth Army's narrow bridgehead at Frankfurt on Oder to destroy Zhukov's forces massing at Kustrin, and thus disrupt the big Soviet offensive. In conference with Himmler, Goering, and Guderian on March 15th, Hitler instructed them to deceive the Russians into expecting the thrust to turn south. This was his new master plan, and it must not fail. That's it for that chapter.